For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're investigating some notoriously good crime writers. After the global success of The Silent Patient, Alex Michaelides discusses his follow-up, The Maidens, another gripping blend of psychology and mythology. Soon to be a major TV series, we revisit Postmortem in the company of former Murder Squad detective turned author Kate London. Penny Melville Brown reviews some left-field crime thrillers. And I review a classic slice of American noir from the pen of Michael Connelly. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Alex Michaelides' debut novel, The Silent Patient, was not only a global bestseller, but became the first debut by a British author to go straight in at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Needless to say, there's been a lot of interest in his follow-up. The Maidens was published earlier this month, and in the midst of a whirlwind of publicity, Alex found time to tell me more about it. Alex Michaelides, welcome to Read On.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
The Maidens is billed as a story of love and grief, what makes us human and what makes us kill. And it's a wonderful blend of psychological thriller and Greek mythology, all bound up in a Cambridge college. Can you tell us what the inspiration was and lead us into the plot, please?
Sure. The story really is about a mysterious and enigmatic and charismatic Greek tragedy professor at Cambridge University, who is suspected of murdering his students, who are all members of a secret society known as the Maidens. And our heroine is a group psychotherapist named Mariana, who becomes obsessed with proving the professor's guilt, even at the risk of losing her own life. And, you know, it came from the same themes that inspired The Silent Patient, really, my first novel, which are Greek mythology, psychology, and murder. And they're the sort of things that continue to preoccupy me. And it's also what I call a psychological detective story. So it's trying to marry a kind of Agatha Christie-style plotting with perhaps a slightly deeper emotional psychological complexity.
Mariana, your group psychotherapist, is a recent widow. And you say very early on in the book that one of the glories of her job is sitting with a circle of patients who can create an energy and in some ways exorcise the demons that the patients are suffering from. They can create an energy that is greater than the circle.
Yes. I mean, I think the group therapy is amazing in lots of ways. What I wanted to explore in the novel is the idea of groups and groups within groups. And so you have the group therapy, which can be extremely healing and therapeutic, but then groups can also be quite damaging and scary too. And so I wanted to look at that as well.
We certainly see that with her group in London. The demons that it raises are damaging and very powerful. And demons are also being raised in Cambridge, where Mariana's niece, Zoe, is a student under this very charismatic Edward Fosker.
Yes. And I studied psychotherapy for a while at a couple of different places. And ultimately, I quit for a variety of reasons. The main one was that I realized that I was a writer and not a therapist. But also, to be honest with you, I encountered a lot of really amazing and talented therapists, but I also encountered an equal number who, to be frank, were as crazy as the people that they were treating. And the final straw for me was being involved in group therapy, because I specialized in group therapy. And the leader of the group was a very famous and important professor who turned out to be really quite a dangerous man, I think. He was narcissistic and sadistic, and there were a lot of very vulnerable people in the group. And instead of trying to foster connections between them and help them heal, he seemed to delight in bullying them and making them cry. And there was a final straw for me was when one man who'd been in the group for 20 years, which is an awfully long time to be in a group, said to him as he was leaving that he didn't know whether this therapist had ever liked him or not. And I thought, what a terrible thing to say to somebody who's supposed to be helping you. And there's something that happens in groups. You know, you can see it throughout politics and history. We tend to almost infantilize ourselves or regress to being children. We place all of our authority in the group leader who more often than not turns out to be a bit crazy. So I wanted to transpose that experience into the maidens, and that's what the character of Edward Fosker, the professor, came from.
He's a parental figure to the young students, the young women, in fact, that he is teaching. And we see him as manipulative and
predatory, in fact.
Narcissistic. His very appearance is flamboyant and meant to impress as well. Mm-hmm. And in sharp relief to him, we see the wonderful character of Clarissa, the pipe-smoking fellow who's been there a lot longer, and who is somebody who Mariana and the other students can trust.
Yes, she was based on a couple of professors I had at Cambridge who were just wonderful, and I'm still very close to one of them. He helped me with the ancient Greek in the book, and he taught me tragedy when I was there. And so I think it's important to have a balance. You know, likewise, there's a character of Ruth who also appears in The Silent Patient, and she was Theo's therapist in The Silent Patient, and she's Mariana's therapist in The Maidens. She's based on a therapist that I had. I was very fortunate to have 10 years of therapy with a really talented, empathetic, wise woman who I arrived into therapy at 20, probably quite messed up and quite depressed and anxious. And she was just an amazing person. And so that was why I feel that I had this kind of ambivalent relationship with therapy, because, you know, on the other hand, some people are incredibly good at it and others aren't. And it, unfortunately, all comes down to the individual skill of the therapist. It's hard to quantify, really. Again, in the book, I wanted to have this kind of mirror images of each other. So we have the really talented and kind Ruth versus the evil and predatory Edward Fosker.
He certainly is. There's a definite element of The Secret History by Donna Tartt in this, the secret society trying to keep ancient beliefs, ancient rituals alive. And I wondered if it is a bit of a nod to Secret History.
Yeah, well, you know, I read it when I was 16. I read it kind of compulsively, like three or four times in a row, you know, chain smoking furiously, just loving it. And I thought it was the most sophisticated, brilliant novel I'd read at that point. And so it had definitely been in my head. But, you know, also it just comes from my own experience because I was a student at Cambridge and I'd always wanted to write about that experience because it's a very closed, secretive world and also, you know, mysterious, but also incredibly beautiful. And I thought it would be a wonderful backdrop for a thriller.
And there's a wonderful sense of nostalgia as Mariana is walking through the streets of Cambridge, which is all set off rather nicely against her reading In Memoriam, which is the Tennyson poem. He, of course, was another Cambridge student who suffered terrible loss when he was at the university. And I wonder, did you go back to Cambridge and trace Mariana's steps or retrace your own steps?
I did, actually. You know, it's very much a novel about being haunted by the past and all the things that we lose as we get older. And so there's a definite air of melancholy and sadness in it. And that's what led me immediately to Tennyson. So I was a student there like 20 years ago, and obviously it's changed. And it hasn't changed, but I've changed. And so I wanted to go back and rediscover it. So I took a notebook and I went back a few times while I was writing the novel for a few days at a time and stayed in a hotel. And then I walked my way through the novel with my notebook, trying to follow Mariana's footsteps exactly. For example, if she was meant to be at the pub at 9 p.m., I would go to the pub at 9 p.m. on the Thursday and sort of take my notebook and sit down and write down sights and sounds and smells and things. And I thought it would be a kind of atmospheric notebook. But what happened was weirder and deeper than that. As Mariana was kind of haunted by her past, I started to be haunted by mine. And I was getting sadder and sadder and lonelier and lonelier and remembering, you know, lovers that I'd lost or friends that I'd lost or even myself at 18. And it really fed into the character. And so she and I kind of fused in a way. And I'm really glad that I did that because I think it adds depth to her and to the novel itself.
And something else that adds depth to Mariana and that you share with her is Greek heritage. Mm-hmm. You were born in Cyprus.
That's right, yes.
And we revisit her last holiday with her husband, where she went to Naxos. And there's a real sense that the Greek myths are still alive on those islands, which certainly is something that I've rather felt when I've been to Cyprus. Uh-huh. You still feel the goddess Athena is there.
Yeah, you know, it's very true. I grew up in Cyprus and Greek mythology is very much in the air there. And the island itself features heavily in Greek mythology. And when I was younger, very, very small, I was a little confused about what was real and what wasn't real. And that idea of a kind of magical realist relationship with Greek mythology had always kind of struck me as something that's interesting to write about. What fascinates me about these myths is that no matter how much you reimagine them, which there's a real trend for it now, or approach them from like a modern psychological perspective or from a feminist perspective or whatever, that the stories still stand up emotionally, psychologically. So in the first novel I wrote, The Silent Patient, Alicia's silence is based on the silence of Alcestis, which Euripides wrote thousands of years ago. And yet all the people who've read the book have really related to it today. So I think it just shows us that they are unbelievably psychologically accurate and timeless. And so that's been a major influence on me my whole life.
We've mentioned The Silent Patient a couple of times, and I'm sure it's a question you're very bored of answering, but having sold 4 million copies of it to date, and it's also with Brad Pitt's production company, I understand, how great was the pressure on you for the second novel?
Well, I won't lie, there was pressure. I mean, when I wrote the first novel, I was transitioning from what I would describe as a failed and failing career as a screenwriter, in that I'd made 3 films and each one was worse than the last. And I thought, okay, before I give up, I have to try and write something for myself. And I'd always had this whispering voice in my head telling me to write a novel. And so I eventually sat down and did it, but I didn't even have an agent at that point. I'd been dropped by my last agent. And so I just wrote it for myself as a love letter to the genre, really. I grew up on the beach in Cyprus reading thrillers, and I'd always wanted to write a thriller for myself to read on the beach. And so that was all that was behind it. And then I was very much, I would say overwhelmed, but definitely taken aback by the success of the book. So when I sat down to write The Maidens, it was a little frightening, and there was a lot of pressure, but mostly self-imposed. However, all I could do is kind of go back to that kid on the beach in Cyprus and try and write another novel for him to read. I really think it's that simple. You have to shut out all these outside voices, because you're never going to please everybody, and just try and focus on pleasing yourself and working as hard as you can. And that's all that I could do, really.
What do you think your career as a screenwriter taught you about presenting a story? Because your novels are incredibly page-turning.
That's very, very kind of you. Thank you. I mean, I get bored easily. I think most people do these days. So I try to keep it moving, which is something I learned from film. I struggled initially to be visual, and it took a lot of really hard work for me to get better as a screenwriter, to try and make things more visual, which I kind of bring into the novels. But also, I don't think I was a terribly good screenwriter. I think that I really struggled to dramatize a scene. And when I wrote my first novel, the discovery you could go inside somebody's head in a book and go backwards and forwards in time and slow time down was a real revelation for me. And I suddenly thought, oh, this is what I'm meant to be doing instead. So I find novel writing more rewarding and easier than scripts.
Did it teach you much about dialogue? Because your books translate fantastically to audio. Louise Brearley, I know, has narrated both books.
She's done an amazing job, yeah. A lot of it is her voice, which is just so hypnotic. She's a really good reader. Yes, I mean, what I do is, you know, it's funny you ask that, because I do actually read them aloud to myself. It's a really important part of the process, and it takes forever. But when I get to a place where I think, okay, this is now ready for someone to read, I then spend about a week sitting down and just reading the whole thing to myself. And it's amazing how much it changes once you read it aloud, because you can be reading something inside your head and sort of have a sense that it's working. And it's only when you hear it out loud do you realize that the rhythm is wrong in lots of places and you need to fix things. So yeah, it's definitely very much a kind of process where it's about what it sounds like, not just inside someone's head, but when they're being read.
And did you have to help Louise with some of the Greek names? And there's a fair amount of ancient Greek for her to read.
No, I didn't. I've never actually met her, but I was concerned about that. But the audio people, Macmillan and Orion, had an expert to record the ancient Greek for her, so she was able to have something to reference as she was reading it, which was a real relief. I mean, a lot of this stuff was risky for me when I was writing the novel. I just thought, is any of this going to work? And how on earth do you have ancient Greek? Because we should say for the listeners, the ancient Greek comes in these form of kind of taunting messages that are left on postcards in the victim's rooms from the murderer. And it was an idea I thought would be quite hypnotic and captivating to read, but I wasn't sure how it would play with the audio. So I'm hugely relieved that it's worked so well.
How had she ended up like this? In the space of just a year, which once would have slipped by almost imperceptibly, and now stretched out behind her like a desolate landscape flattened by a hurricane, the life she had known had been obliterated, leaving Mariana here, 36 years old, alone and drunk on a Sunday night, clutching a dead man's shoes as if they were holy relics, which, in a way, they were.
Louise Brearley narrating The Maidens, written by my guest, Alex Michaelides.
Alex, after the success of The Silent Patient, your American publisher decided to announce the publication of The Maidens by taking out a billboard on Times Square and showing the cover of the new book. For a blind and partially sighted audience, could you describe it for us, please?
It's the head of a statue, a female statue, and there's a little bit of blood creeping around her neck, sort of splashed around the bottom. And what I really love about it is that the texture behind the head is a kind of mosaic that is slightly being shattered and broken up, which I think references the Greek element of the story really well, but also it references that there's something lurking beneath and that there are secrets that we keep from each other and also from ourselves as well, which is a big theme of the book.
And the book is also full of the most wonderful little Easter eggs. We've already mentioned that Ruth from The Silent Patient makes a reappearance, as does Theo.
Yes, I wanted to try and give a little bit of a surprise for readers of The Silent Patient, because many people keep asking me to write a sequel to that book, and I don't know if I will, but I very much like the idea of having these novels set in the same world, because Mariana and Theo are both psychotherapists, and it occurred to me that they would probably know each other in that small world in London. And also, to be honest with you, it's something that I stole from Agatha Christie, because her novels are all set in the same universe. And it's something really fascinating, I think, because, you know, in one novel, an inspector has a small part, and in another novel, he has a major part, and they kind of cross over into each other's books. And there's even a suggestion in one of her novels that Hercule Poirot met Sherlock Holmes's mother. And I love that, because she's crashing into another writer's fictional universe there. And it adds a kind of 3D reality to the books, which I think is really interesting.
And just like Agatha Christie and all those wonderful golden age of crime authors, you love to throw in a few red herrings. I was wondering, do you do that while you're writing, or do you drop them in afterwards?
I don't know. It's hard to describe, really. It's like a process of painting, I suppose, where you just start with something quite basic and then you get more and more detailed, the more layers you put on top of it. And so I think of it a bit like that, where it starts out very much like broad strokes, and then I get more and more specific as time goes on. And you go backwards and forwards, adding little bits here and there. But all of this I learned from Christie, because, you know, I referenced her a lot, and I wouldn't say she's a particularly amazing stylist, but there is absolutely nothing that she does not know about plot and setups and payoffs and red herrings and twists. And there's not a word that's wasted in an Agatha Christie novel. You think early on you're reading something that's quite irrelevant and random, and then later on, when you finish the book, you realise quite how important that passage was or that clue was. And so she has absolute genius at construction. And these novels are, I think, for me, very much about the architecture. So a lot of it is about the magic trick, is how I think of it, that you're performing. And so you have to get the reader or the audience to look at the wrong thing and look at the wrong direction while you secretly try and trip them up. And so it's a game that you're playing with the reader. Yeah, absolutely.
I am a huge fan of those books as well, and I love the little nods that you give to, well, all those wonderful authors. I felt that Dorothy L. Sayers was lurking behind a pillar at
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, I've always loved Dorothy L. Sayers, and I love Gaudy Knight, her novel, and The Maidens is very much my answer to Gaudy Knight, because that's set at an Oxford college, and there hasn't really been anything like that at a Cambridge college, so I thought I might try and jump in there and do that. But also the location, to go back to our earlier comments, it was about the need within that genre to have a kind of iconic enclosed location. So when I was working at a psychiatric unit years ago for teenagers, I suddenly thought, oh, a psychiatric unit would be a fantastic place to have a murder mystery. And Christie had never done that. And then when I finished The Silent Patient, I thought, okay, well, what else might I try and do, what that Christie might do or had never done? And she'd never said anything at a college like Dorothy L. Sayers, because unlike Sayers, she didn't go to university. And so I think she was wary of writing about something, a world that she had no experience of. But I did have an experience of it, and I thought, okay, well, I can try and have this as a backdrop for a thriller.
It certainly works very well. And I also love the fact that, rather like Dorothy Sayers, you like to sprinkle facts in just to make us come away feeling like we've learnt something as well as being thoroughly entertained. I had never realised that St. Lucy was the patron saint of the blind or actually the derivation of the word psychopath?
That's interesting, and it's nice of you to say that. I think that the books that I write kind of cross over genres slightly. I don't read a lot of modern day thrillers. I find them to be quite often, obviously there's some really amazing ones, but often I find them to be a little bit empty. And I prefer books that are a bit deeper and have more going on. And so I tend to read a lot of classic kind of literary fiction, Dickens or Evelyn Waugh or Henry James, people like that. And so it's really important to try and make the books as rich an experience as you can for the reader. So it's not just about an empty plot, but it's about deep characters and a deep world that they're living in.
You've very kindly given up your morning to talk to me amid a whirlwind of publicity surrounding The Maidens. Are you finding time to write the third novel?
Yeah, you know what's really funny is that I thought after The Maidens, because it's taken me a while to write this book, I thought I would take a long break before I wrote something else, and I thought I would be completely burnt out. But what's happened, I think because the second novel, they call it the difficult second novel for a reason, there's expectation, and also you've spent years writing your first book, and then suddenly you have to turn around and write something else. And so it's really a difficult process, and I found writing the book enjoyable but extremely difficult. And so I thought I wouldn't write anything, but somehow by completing it, it's freed me up in the most unexpected and wonderful way. So I immediately began writing something else and writing in a very different way to previously. So the thing I'm writing now, I'm not really planning much, which is really unlike me. I'm sort of surprising myself each day as I'm writing it. And it's a really great experience. So I feel quite buoyant, actually, at the moment.
Well, I hope you will come back onto the show to discuss that when it is published. But in the meantime, Alex Michaelides, thank you so much for taking us into the world of The Maidens, discussing your life as an author, and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
The Maidens by Alex Michaelides is out now commercially wherever you buy your books. And Alex will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Start your day with a morning adventure every weekday from 8 a.m.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
A book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
And our usual talking book slot every weekday at 2 p.m. or if you prefer a book at bedtime, it's repeated at 10 p.m. And you'll find many episodes online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, my investigations get gritty and noir in LA in the company of Hieronymus Bosch. But first, from its earliest beginnings in the Rue Morgue, via characters who've become household names like Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot and Inspector Morse, crime fiction has always been a publishing phenomenon. Kate London is a rising star in the firmament of British crime writers. She first appeared on the show back in 2017 to discuss her critically acclaimed debut novel, Postmortem. It's a gripping, poignant story that draws on her service in the Metropolitan Police to produce a perfect blend of police procedural and character-led crime fiction. And later this year, Postmortem will be coming to our screens as a major ITV crime drama. So let's go back to the first time that I pulled the former detective in for questioning.
Picture the scene. A policeman and a teenage girl plunged to their deaths from the roof of a London housing estate. Was it murder, suicide, or just a tragic accident? Detective Sergeant Sarah Collins has to find out in Postmortem. This is the debut novel from Kate London, who puts her years of experience in London's Metropolitan Police to great use to produce a gripping crime story. It was certainly one of the highlights of my 2016 audiobook year. So I invited her onto the show to talk about her novel.
The universe was turning, and she wanted to slow it down and hold on to every particle, to have time to examine it, to revolve it slowly in the light. Every human action contaminated.
So, Kate, Postmortem at times feels almost documentary in its authenticity.
Yes, well, I was a police officer, and when I joined the police, I didn't mean to write. My intention was to put away that side of my life. But when I was actually working on Borough and dealing with people, it was a world that was so rich, where you saw people so fully, because you see people in extremis, whether they're victims, witnesses, suspects, whatever's happened, they're suddenly in a place where they're perhaps more fully revealed than they are in other times of their lives. And I just found that I had to write about it. It's a very funny world, it's a dangerous world, it's a boring world. And I just found that I had to write about it. And so that's how it was. I just found myself writing.
And did the plot itself come from something that actually happened, or is the internal investigation that forms the crux of this book purely from your imagination?
Everything in the book is imagined. There's nobody real in the book. There's no real police officer or real story. None of this happened. But I think the experience of being with police officers and seeing the day-to-day dilemmas that they face, the questions of integrity, the stakes around integrity, the fact that if a police officer makes a mistake that might, in a civilian world, have not very great consequences, for a police officer it would have huge consequences. And one of my inspirations was a film, Au revoir les enfants, which is a film about the Nazi occupation of France, in which a boy is dealing on the black market with his mother's jam. And the consequences of that are enormous, because the place where he's at school, they are hiding three Jewish boys. And it is his use of the black market that leads to these boys being discovered and dying in Auschwitz. And I think that was one of the things that I was trying to write about in the police, the feeling that it's a place where, because of the unique nature of the job, the consequences can be very great for actions that wouldn't bear such consequences in other life.
One of your two protagonists, Detective Sergeant Sarah Collins, is an internal affairs detective, which makes her both an insider and an outsider. And I thought that that really made her a gumshoe. She has to be loyal only to establishing the truth. It doesn't matter what the cost is to her colleagues, so long as she can establish the truth and solve the case. Did you set out to mix the two subgenres and produce something really quite novel?
No, I didn't. I started to write, and Sarah developed, and I came to like Sarah more and more, and to be more and more interested in her. And I think her sort of purity and her determination is very special. And I think the juxtaposition of the two women and their two circumstances is one of the things that made the book work for me as I was writing it. But it was something that happened in the writing and that became richer and richer. And it was only towards the very end that I realised that, of course, they were dual protagonists. To begin with, I had thought that Lizzie was the sole protagonist, but Sarah just grew.
And Lizzie is the young police officer who is doing her 2 years in uniform before moving on to her next job. Where do you see Lizzie ending up?
Well, it's giving away what happens a bit in Postmortem, but in the second book, Lizzie has moved on and she's a training detective. And I think what's interesting about the two women is that in their different ways, they're both idealists, and yet they are very different and their take on idealism is very different. So we see Lizzie in the second book training as a detective, and we see Sarah too has moved on, but the two women encounter each other again because a particular case brings them together.
I'm delighted to hear that there is a sequel, because ever since listening to the audiobook version of Postmortem, I have been wondering what was going to happen to the two of them. And so when is the sequel due, and can you share the name with us?
April 2017, and the title is Death Message. Death message is what the police refer to when somebody's died. The police will say to each other, who is delivering the death message? Which means, who is going to tell the next of kin that somebody has died? Obviously, it's a very important role, and that's the title of the book.
Collins held out her warrant card. Detective Sergeant Sarah Collins. The inspector stepped towards her. He was tall, a streak of grey in his hair. What are you doing up here? This is a crime scene. I could ask the same of you, sir. Something like anger flushed briefly through his face. Kieran Shaw. I'm the duty inspector. It's clear enough what I'm doing here. One of my officers is dead. Another is up here on her own with a missing child. I'm here to make sure no one else falls off this roof.
So the audiobook version of Postmortem came out at roughly the same time as the printed version?
I believe so. I'm not sure exactly the dates. I think it was a little bit after the actual book came out. We were talking about audiobooks and saying how important they're becoming as part of the package of publication, because more and more people are using them. Sighted people, as well as people with disabilities who are finding it more difficult to read. And people are using them when they're driving, they're using them when they're cooking, they can multitask and listen to a book at the same time. And so the quality of the actual reading and the recording is very, very important. And I was very pleased. I was pleased when I listened to it. I was pleased with the actress and with the way that it had been done. It was very sympathetic, I felt, to what I was trying to do. And I must say that as an author, it's lovely. It's just so lovely that your book has been read by somebody, that people think highly enough to take the time to record it, to read it, to put that effort into it. I mean, it's just a lovely experience.
Thank you very much, and please carry on providing us with great oral material.
Great, lovely, pleasure.
All three of Kate London's excellent crime novels to date are available commercially in print, ebook, and audio. And look out for Postmortem on your TV screens in the autumn.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval commander and the founder of Disability Dynamics and Baking Blind, both of which seek to highlight the capabilities of blind and other disabled people. She's also an avid bookworm with a serious audiobook habit, and she's kindly agreed to record a series of book reviews for RNIB Connect Radio. Penny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rid.
So what have you got in store for us today?
Well, I thought I'd choose some really odd books just to, one, give people a bit of variety and prove that I don't spend all my time reading detective stories and thrillers, although, of course, some of these are. Let me move on to the first one. Now, it's called Hinkston's Box by Decima Blake. This is a real curiosity, and I read lots of American detective stories, but this is an American voice reading a story about an English detective, and it's very strange to hear all these English words being spoken in American. But I also think that Decima Blake, whoever he or she is almost certainly an American, because you can hear that the sentence structure and the vocabulary aren't quite right. But it is still a really interesting story. And it's about mystery and murder mayhem involving two sets of twins, but their mysteries are 100 years apart. And all of this is discovered by an English detective called Hinkston. And it all revolves around a box he discovers. And also, he's a man who's prone to night panics and all sorts of other psychological disturbances that actually help him piece together this mystery. Da, 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 da.
That sounds brilliant and a completely new one on me.
Yes, I've never heard of this writer before. It's an interesting book. It's not a great book, but it's certainly interesting. And I liked the psychological side of it. I thought that was really fascinating.
The bullets in this jar, he balanced the vessel between his thumb and forefinger, were taken from the body of murdered Constable Choate. Standing tall, Detective Sergeant Jason Hingston scanned the audience, his eyes revealing the compassion that his trained voice disguised. The members of the Metropolitan Police History Society, largely male and mature in service, sat forward in their seats. Their faces were solemn as they hung on to the words of Hingston, the youngest society member, aged 32. Hingston continued, "This jar is one of over a dozen of its kind. You will see them later tonight in the Houndsditch Murders collection on display in the museum downstairs." A round of applause followed, and the chair of the History Society, a white-haired, retired chief superintendent named Finn Mannix, walked onto the stage.
J.R. Hamilton narrating Hingston's Box by Decima Blake, which is available from the R&IB Library.
Well, the second book I've chosen this time is by Robert Crace, and he's another American writer, and actually one of my favourites, because he normally writes about private investigator Elvis Cole and his sidekick, who's very tough, called Pike. But this is a different book by him called Suspect. And it's all about an explosives detection dog that was with the army in Afghanistan and then got wounded and is now in the police force in America with a handler who has also been wounded. And so you can see this heartwarming story of man and dog recovering together. Do I sound suitably tragic as I say that? Actually, it's not like that at all. It's not sloppy about dogs and all that heartwarming stuff, because that's not the sort of book I would ever read. It's much more to the point, get on with it, a good little suspense thriller detective story in which one of the characters happens to be a dog. So if you want something completely different, try this one.
Uniformed LAPD officer Stephanie Anders, a P3 with 11 years on the job, shifted into park, turned off their Adam car, and stared at him. She had a fine tanned face with lines at the corners of her eyes and short sandy hair. Scott James, a 32-year-old P2 with 7 years on the job, grinned as he touched his ear, telling her to listen. Stephanie seemed lost for a moment, then blossomed with a wide smile. "It's quiet." "Crazy, huh? No radio calls, no chatter. I can't even hear the freeway."
McLeod Andrews narrating Suspect by Robert Crace, which is available commercially.
And my last one, and I've just realised that these are all writers from the other side of the Atlantic, but this one is Margaret Atwood, who is Canadian. And many people will have heard about Margaret Atwood because she won the Booker Prize with her novel The Handmaid's Tale. And then she was joint winner for this second novel, which is called The Testaments. The Handmaid's Tale was all about the suppression of women, the corruption of power, religious extremism, and surprisingly, all set very credibly in America. And now The Testaments is the sequel to that book, and it was written some 35 years later, and indeed, time has passed considerably in this sequel. And it's written in the voices of three of the key protagonists who emerge from the first book. And you start getting more insight into that corruption, that suppression of women, that religious extremism. And it smacks very much of the sort of society that brought Trump to power and that Trump was actually exploiting for his continuation of power. I'm not sure that Atwood was writing it quite so overtly politically aimed at Trump, but certainly when she wrote her first book, The Handmaid's Tale, she said that every aspect of it was true, not necessarily set in America, but that sort of suppression, the corruption of power and the religious extremism was happening somewhere in the world and had prompted her to write that book. And now we get more insight into it, more maturity, more reflection on actually what was happening, and things might be a little more complicated than we first perceived. I really recommend this book, and if chaps out there are thinking, oh, I don't want to read some book about women, actually, there's loads of malevolent violence and mayhem lurking behind every page. So it's more gripping than perhaps I've made it sound.
Only dead people are allowed to have statues, but I have been given one while still alive. Already, I am petrified. This statue was a small token of appreciation for my many contributions, said the citation, which was read out by Aunt Vidala. She'd been assigned the task by our superiors and was far from appreciative. I thanked her with as much modesty as I could summon, then pulled the rope that released the cloth drape shrouding me. It billowed to the ground, and there I stood. We don't do cheering here at Ardua Hall, but there was some discreet clapping.
The Testaments by Margaret Atwood, which is narrated by an ensemble cast, is available from the RNIB Library.
Penny Melville Brown, thank you for another hat trick of fantastic recommendations and for coming back onto the show.
My pleasure, Red. See you again.
Thanks again to Penny.
Now, before we return to Alex Michaelides to hear the books of his life, you're listening to Read On. I'm always keen to fill the gaps on my library shelves, particularly when I've heard good things about an author but haven't got round to reading anything by them yet. It's why I love to hear your educating read and hidden gem suggestions. So, when Mr. Bean screenwriter Robin Driscoll appeared on the show recently and suggested a Michael Connelly thriller as one of the books of his life, I knew it was time to plug that particular gap on my crime fiction shelves. I tracked down Trunk Music in the RNIB library, and from the opening paragraph, I knew I was on a roller coaster.
As he drove along Mulholland Drive toward the Cahuenga Pass, Bosch began to hear the music. It came to him in fragments of strings and errant horn sequences, echoing off the brown summer-dried hills and blurred by the white noise of traffic carrying up from the Hollywood freeway. Nothing he could identify. All he knew was that he was heading toward its source. He slowed when he saw the cars parked off to the side of a gravel turnoff road, two detective sedans and a patrol car. Bosch pulled his Caprice in behind them and got out. A single officer in uniform leaned against the fender of the patrol car. Yellow plastic crime scene tape, the stuff used by the Miles in Los Angeles, was strung from the patrol car's side-view mirror across the gravel road to the sign posted on the other side. The sign said, in black on white letters that were almost indistinguishable behind the graffiti that covered the sign, LAFD Fire Control, Mountain Fire District Road. No public admittance, no smoking.
Harry Bosch is a tough, uncompromising LAPD homicide detective. Back after an involuntary leave of absence, he's eager to get his teeth into his first new case. When a Hollywood producer called Tony Aliso is found in the boot of a white Rolls-Royce, bound and shot twice in the head, Harry swings into action. At first, it looks like a mafia hit, but as he digs deeper into the film producer's sleazy career, Harry quickly discovers that a lot of people had Tony Aliso in their sights, including some who were supposed to be on the right side of the law. Then, just as he seems to have made a breakthrough, Harry's integrity is called into question and he's pulled off the case. But nothing short of a bullet can stop Harry Bosch when he's searching for the truth. Trunk Music is a page-turner from start to finish. Anyone who's a fan of the hard-boiled crime fiction of Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, and Lee Child will love it. Its twisting, pacey plot would do justice to any 1940s film noir, complete with femme fatale, sleazy dives, and hard-talking tough guys.
Harry Bosch has a lot in common with Chandler's Philip Marlowe. Both are uncompromisingly moral characters in a tawdry world. And the fact that they suffer because of it makes them more sympathetic and maybe even lovable. This side of him gives Bosch depth and makes him more than just a Dirty Harry figure. Trunk Music is the fifth book in the series and it was published in 2000. Only the references to what was then cutting-edge technology jarred as I read it. Otherwise, like all the best crime fiction, its plot is ageless. If at times it's a little far-fetched, then I was just too busy reading on to care. I'm already looking forward to picking up another book in the series. Trunk Music, narrated by Dick Hill, is TB14313. And there's a wide selection of books by Michael Connolly, including many others featuring Harry Bosch, in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And if you like your detective fiction hard-boiled, why not try some of the following suggestions? The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. Widely regarded as one of the greatest crime novels of all time, it was also made into the archetypal film noir starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. The Talking Book version is read by Marvin Kane and is TB1165.
It was about 11 o'clock in the morning, mid-October, with the sun not shining, and a look of hard, wet rain in the clearness of the foothills. I was wearing my powder blue suit with dark shirt, tie and display handkerchief, black brogues, black wool socks with dark blue clocks on them. I was neat, clean, shaved and sober, and I didn't care who knew it. I was everything the well-dressed private detective ought to be. I was calling on $4 million.
The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. Written in 1930, this classic crime thriller follows hard-bitten private investigator Sam Spade as he tracks down a jewel-encrusted statue that has already cost Spade's partner his life. It, likewise, is narrated by Marvin Kane and is TB2467. Killing Floor by Lee Child, the first of the British writer's Jack Reacher novels, is about a former US military policeman with a dark past and a determination to hunt down his brother's killers. Killing Floor, written by Lee Child and narrated by Jay Benedict, is TB15483.
I was arrested at Nino's Diner at 12 o'clock. I was eating eggs and drinking coffee. A late breakfast, not lunch. I was wet and tired after a long walk in heavy rain, all the way from the highway to the edge of town. The diner was small but bright and clean, brand new, built to resemble a converted railroad car, narrow with a long lunch counter on one side and a kitchen bumped out back, booths lining the opposite wall, a door where the center booth would be.
Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Alex Michaelides for the books of his life.
Alex, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, many, I suppose, but the first one that really comes to mind would be Five Little Pigs by Agatha Christie. I discovered Christie when I was about 12, I think, and I snuck into my elder sister's room where I don't quite know why. I never actually asked her. Maybe she must have bought them because she's a bit older than me. She had a whole selection of Agatha Christie's on her shelf, and I stole one and kept reading, couldn't stop reading them all. I read them compulsively. And the one that had the biggest effect on me, I think, was Five Little Pigs, which I think I would venture to say is her greatest novel. It's an absolutely stunning piece of work. It's about a young woman whose mother murdered her father 16 years before, and she asks Hercule Poirot to investigate the crime. And he then has to kind of interview, five characters, and each of them shared a different light on the story that happened before. And what's brilliant about this novel is that the cast of characters is so small and the suspects are so few. And yet it's a bit like a jewel, really, because you'll never get it. And then when you do get it at the end, very much on like the final page, it's absolutely devastating because it makes you realize that you've misunderstood the whole book and you've seen everything from the wrong angle. And it's one of her few books, I think, where the resolution of the plot and the resolution of the character occur in the same story beat. And so it's just, it's a perfect, perfect book. And I thought one day I would like to try and write something like that. And I've not achieved it yet, but I hope to one day.
You seem to remember these points very well, murmured Poirot slyly. Superintendent Hale blushed.
I'm just passing on the impression I got, he said austerely.
Quite, said Poirot soothingly. He went on, so it would seem that the principal witnesses against Mrs. Crail were Philip Blake and Elsa Greer.
Yes, vehement they were, both of them. But the governess was called by the prosecution, too, and what she said carried more weight than the other two. She was on Mrs. Crail's side entirely, you see, up in arms for her. But she was an honest woman, and gave her evidence truthfully, without trying to minimise it in any way.
And Meredith Blake?
He was very distressed by the whole thing, poor gentleman, as well he might be. Blamed himself for his drug brewing, and the coroner blamed him for it too. Canine and A.E. salts comes under Schedule 1 of the Poisons Act. He came in for some pretty sharp censure. He was a friend of both parties, and it hit him very hard. Besides being the kind of country gentleman who shrinks from notoriety and being in the public eye.
Hugh Fraser narrating Five Little Pigs by Agatha Christie, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I would have to say it's Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers. And when I wrote The Maidens, I wanted to try and revisit that world because there's something so... Yes, they investigate crimes, Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane, that there's something about their relationship, about the on-off love affair, his pursuing of her and her kind of cautious approach towards him, their banter as they investigate the crimes. And when I was young and I read it, I wanted to be with them. And I still want to be with them when I read it now. I really just think, oh, I wish I could kind of go on an adventure with Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane and solve a crime. And so there's something about that that I find incredibly comforting and nurturing. It's a really beautiful relationship. I read once, I mean, this may not be true, but I read once that she had said that she had fallen in love with him, and I, with Peter Wimsey, with her creation. And you can see that there's a real wistfulness and a sweetness to their relationship. And you really, as a reader, you really want them to get together. And so, you know, spoiler alert, but when they do finally get together at the end of Gaudy Night, it's such a joyous thing. And it gives me the most immense pleasure to read that book.
How do you manage about your plots? All that timetable work with the alibis and so on must be terribly hard to bear in mind.
I'm always getting mixed up myself, admitted Harriet. I've never yet succeeded in producing a plot without at least 6 major howlers. Fortunately, 9 readers out of 10 get mixed up too, so it doesn't matter. The 10th writes me a letter, and I promise to make the correction in the 2nd edition, but I never do. After all, my books are only meant for fun. It's not like a work of scholarship.
You always had a scholarly mind, though, said Miss Lydgate, and I expect you find your training a help in some ways, don't you? I used to think you might take up an academic career. Are you disappointed that I didn't? No, indeed. I think it's so nice that our students go out and do such varied and interesting things, provided they do them well. And I must say, most of our students do exceedingly good work along their own lines.
Stephen Jack, narrating Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, very much so. This is not a modern novel, but I've only read it recently. I'm currently working my way through Ruth Rendell writing as Barbara Vine, because the psychological thrillers that she wrote as Barbara Vine are masterpieces. I mean, talk about something rich. There's this book that I read now called Astor's Book, which I took to Spain with me. And in between interviews, I was just pulling it out and just desperately reading it, so I couldn't stop. And it's about a woman who lives in Hampstead, and her grandmother was a diarist in 1900 in London, a Danish woman. And these diaries were published to great international acclaim. And she gets approached one day by a journalist who says that there was a reference to a murder in one of the diaries. And she asks her to look up the originals because they're written in Danish. And so our heroine, Anne, goes to the original of one of the diaries and finds that five pages have been torn out. And then the mystery begins. And, you know, it's about a murder in the past. It's about a dead baby. It's about being a foreigner living in London in 1900. These characters are just so incredibly rich and real. I was thinking about it yesterday, trying to understand why I was so obsessed with it. And I think it's because she's not only a brilliant, brilliant plotter, she has the gift of making characters come alive. And I fell in love with them. And I feel quite bereft now that I've finished this book. And I'm going to give it to everyone I know. So I really recommend that people listen to it.
One of Mormore's favourite stories was of Swanee's courtship. She called it a romance and talked about it with great pride. For though both her daughters had made what she called good marriages, my father had spoilt my mother's by dying young. In spite of speaking Danish like natives, neither Swanee nor my mother went to Denmark until they were grown up. Swanee, at 19, had never got over the death of her favourite brother in the First World War. Mormor sent her to stay with her own cousins, the Holbechs, the son and daughter-in-law of her Aunt Frederica in Copenhagen. This was Padanaram time, when they were living in some style, and there was money. As in the song, Torben Kaer saw a stranger across a crowded room. He was a young diplomat home on leave from a posting in South America, where he was second secretary. Swanee was a bridesmaid at the wedding of a girl called Dorte, and Torben was one of the guests. Apparently, he fell in love with her at first sight. He asked her to marry him 2 days later and accompany him back to wherever it was, Quito or Asunción.
Norma West narrating Asta's book by Barbara Vine, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Alex Michaelides, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for books with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.